This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Place to Be Nation. Welcome back to PTBN's NBA Team Podcast. I am one of your co-hosts, Andrew Reich. I am joined by my other co-host, Adam Murray. How are you doing?
I am doing great. Football is over. Now we can focus on basketball. And that's a good thing.
Well, are you tired of the football? I mean, you're up there Patriot land, so everybody's still up in arms.
Everybody just needs to... a storyline. Oh, they cheated. Oh, it's tarnished. You know what? Who cares anymore? I'm not even a Patriots defender. It's just overkill. It's just, you're just trying to, okay, you want to make them bad guys, go for storylines. But in the end, who really cares? Seattle blew it.
Well, the Super Bowl is natural overkill. You know, I mean, everything that they do is, like, followed ad nauseum when it comes to, like, what commercials are they going to air and, you know, prop bets on who's going to throw the most interceptions and who's going to have the game-winning touchdown, who's going to have the most yards. And it always gets overblown with the Super Bowl. I do think this one lived up to the hype. You know, I've seen almost since I think the first Super Bowl I saw was 25, and that was a great one between the Giants and the Bills. And – you know, there really weren't that many great Super Bowls before that. So we've been blessed in this generation. You know, this generation has kind of passed us by, but we've been able to watch a lot of really great Super Bowls over the last 10 or 15 years. And this one was no exception. So congratulations to the New England Patriots, if you really needed it, on winning Super Bowl 49 against the Seattle Seahawks in a fantastic game. We're going to get away from football, in a minute, but I did want to dwell on this a bit because, you know, like Deflategate going into the Super Bowl, all the talk coming out of University of Phoenix Stadium in Glendale was the last call where the Seahawks got to the goal line. They have Marshawn Lynch. They need a touchdown to take the lead. A field goal won't do, and they go for a pass first. What was your reaction when you saw it?
If they completed it, he would be a genius for thinking outside of the box. And, oh, everybody was expecting run. They passed it. Pete Carroll's a wizard. And, you know, nobody would ask the question if they made it. Only because he didn't. Well, that's stupid and whatnot. Well, you know, it is what it is. He called the pass play. They made the pass play. Whatever.
It was intercepted by Malcolm Butler. He became, you know, the greatest of all time for at least a minute, you know, and he got a free car out of it. A free truck, huh? Like an MVP truck?
He got a free truck. He's going to get – somebody's going to sign him to a big deal. And by a big deal, I mean, you know
– yeah, like a Larry Brown deal or a Dexter Jackson deal.
Yeah, Dexter Jackson's a perfect one. He's great for Tampa Bay. All of a sudden, you know, Arizona gives him like $30 million. You never hear from him again.
Let's try to transition this to basketball a little bit like we did with Deflategate. When it comes to, like, this one's tough because the NBA, they're great. I think the coaches in the NBA are underrated. I think a lot of them are smarter than people think. But do you think there's a lot of scenarios that we've seen over the last maybe few years or maybe decade where a team maybe outsmarted themselves by trying something other than what works?
I don't know because at that late stage of the game, you're already set and you can't. You just go for your shot. Can it be a bad play? Yeah, but...
yeah.
As, you know, oh, let's drop the play and, you know, let's have somebody horrible shoot the three instead.
Yeah.
But it's too quick to, I think, to psych yourself out.
Well, that's the thing, too. These teams get on runs all the time at the end of playoffs games because they get desperate. And a lot of people, if a team, like, kind of blows a lead, it always gets thrown back at either the star player for not being assertive enough or the coach. You know, he choked. He didn't call the right plays. You know, Stan Van Gundy got that tag. I remember when they coached against the Boston Celtics, and they were ready to fire Stan Van Gundy right there before they came back and won the series. That was when he was with Orlando in 2009. But I remember I did an interview on the podcast when you were gone with Coach Snick at B-Ball Breakdown, and he said that a lot of things that really perturb him about the NBA is that he'll see a couple of plays that are really beautifully run plays where there's motion and stuff, because he's an X's and O's guys at heart, like every coach is. But then, you know, the thing that he doesn't understand, and I kind of agree with him, they don't run that stuff all the time. You know, they don't run their sets like a triangle or some type of some other type of nifty offense. They don't do that. Like, they do something that works and then they get away from it. Do you think that's more of a byproduct of the fact that the star players kind of run the show on the court and they want to kind of go into hero ball when the game gets late?
Well, I think it's a two-part question. I think for the most part, you can't keep running sets because that'll just keep slowing down the game. You just want to keep it moving. You just want to sort of get through the first three quarters.
Mm-hmm.
Whether, you know, you're better than the other team, you're ahead, or you don't want to be down to. But for the most part, it's just, let's just run our thing, just run some motion, run in circles a bit, for lack of better terms. And then
the fourth quarter is about execution.
Yeah, you run a play or two. Then it's just, I need to make the shot, as opposed to, well, I need to run to this point. And by that point, you're sort of just on autopilot, and you're just running the same plays. And, you know, are they running them to the T? Are they just running them sloppily? Or just, all right, let's just set a few screens and get somebody open.
Yeah, and I don't think the players are exactly dumb. Like, these players don't know how to run the plays. No, I think these players have done from high school to college to playing for years in the NBA, I think all these players know how to run these plays. It's a matter of how firmly they execute the play. You know, sometimes you get a sloppy screen, and if you don't get a good wide screen, it's going to screw up the whole thing, and the play kind of dies. You know, one bad move can mess it up. It doesn't mean the player doesn't know how to run the play. It just means he didn't really move his feet effectively in that one moment, and that's what screwed up the whole thing. You know, I think this stuff really comes up even greater when you get late into a game and you have to make a snap judgment, whether it's the player on the court and he takes a really bad three. We've seen those a lot. And then you see the coaches come in and say, okay, I want to run this as my last possession. So if it screws up, the players can just blame the coach.
Yeah, but that's just one play. But like before that, it's just, I'd say it's more sort of like a zone reaction. Okay, if this guy's blocked, I'm going to pass to this guy. Mm. Okay, well, if that goes there, I should go do this instead, as opposed to we need to run the play to the T, and everybody needs to, you know, that's just for one set play. You don't have time to think four or five plays ahead.
And Coach Snick mentioned that too, like the idea of playing the averages, you know, the idea of, well, the New England Patriots were one of the worst in like stuff defense, meaning like at the goal line, and you have Marshawn Lynch and such and such. So if you play to the and someone mentioned that, well, the Seahawks were more successful actually throwing the ball at that goal line than they were running the ball all season. So if you really look at the numbers, passing the ball was smarter. But Coach Nick made a great point about basketball, is that why would an accumulation of data over a bunch of games that happen like way across the country influence what decision I make in the end of my game? It should go by heat of the moment. And in that heat of the moment for the Seahawks, the inclination is run the football. Don't fucking throw it. I know they threw a touchdown at the end of the first half to tie it, but in that situation on a slant, that was just incredibly risky, and it just didn't pay off. But, you know, It's like the ball's in the air, good coach, bad coach. And maybe
exactly.
same thing with the NBA in a ways, but I never saw it as good coach, bad coach when an NBA player takes a final shot. It's just a matter of – it really just comes down, can you make it or miss it, you know? And sometimes you and I have seen it a million times in the NBA. Some of these players just make incredible shots. We saw it just recently with Anthony Davis. Is Monty Williams suddenly a good coach because Anthony Davis made an incredible shot against the Oklahoma City Thunder? I don't know. I'll never call Monty a good coach, so you know my answer, but you get my point. But no, we just wanted to get out of the way. Super Bowl 49 is over. Football season is over, and now we're on to the NBA basketball at the forefront along with college basketball, and we're about to reach the All-Star break. But before we even talk about the All-Star break or anything like that, we want to get into a little bit of business going on in the regular season. We're going to be talking about a winning streak, but we're not going to be talking about the Atlanta Hawks, because the Atlanta Hawks winning streak ended at the hands of New Orleans Pelicans at New Orleans on, I believe, Monday or Tuesday. That was an 18-game winning streak that got snapped. They already won two in a row after that. And the most recent one that ended that went about 12 games was, guess who? The Cleveland Cavaliers. So what did you think of that one?
You knew at some point they were going to get hot. They won a 12. Nobody would be surprised if you said, did you hear Cleveland won 12 in a row? No way. I thought they were terrible because they lost their first game. But you know who I think is the reason for this, is sort of the catalyst? And no, it's not Kevin Love, you know, getting his groove back.
Like Stella?
Yeah. Oh, Kevin Love's sad. His numbers have gone down. Boo-hoo. No, I think it's when they added Mozgov.
Mm-hmm.
It now shored up the center that they didn't have, and Varejao wasn't really that type of banger.
He's not a pure center anyway. He was always kind of like a flash power forward.
And yeah, so now they have, like, you just look at his numbers, it's just like he's, like, been averaging a double-double now, and you know he's getting, nobody's passing him the ball, and nobody's even looking for him.
Well, Mozgov, I mean, that puts weight to it, literally. You know, there's a lot of weight to that because of the fact that you got a guy that can just sit there at center. It helps. It shores up your interior defense a little bit, even though I don't know how great of a one-on-one defender he really is. I mean, as a center, you don't have to. I mean, look at Rudy Gobert. He's having a great season. He's not a great one-on-one defender. He's just really freaking big. You know, it's hard to get through him. And
well, the thing is, you know, Kevin Love doesn't want to play down low. So in this, you see the same thing in New Orleans with Ashiq. You have a nice center. Therefore, that allows now Davis and Love to now move around and go find their shot and do their jumpers.
Do you give a little bit of credit to J.R. Smith and Iman Shumpert?
Maybe, you know, trading Dion away was more of a problem than we thought.
Well, Dion's not doing – he's had a couple of good games in the abs when Durant would sit out with some, you know, some ailments, but I've seen his stat lines and some of them been ugly.
He's been off and on, but, you know, I that's not quite unexpected considering that team is kind of – they're a little bit of a mess right now, I think.
Yeah.
But for the most part, you know, J.R. Smith, you know, is just going to shoot, and he doesn't really – He just sort of knows his role now. He's like, look, okay, you're going to pay me to shoot threes. That's all I'll do. Mm-hmm. Shumpert, he's coming
off of the shoulder injury anyway. And well, he's a good defender, and he's a good slasher. So if LeBron needs a blow, Shumpert can be that guy at the forward spot that can either defend the best guard or go to the basket. But he's more of a controlled slasher. He's not like Deion Waiters, where he just goes in aimlessly trying to go for layups, which Waiters is not even good at. Shumpert's a little bit better of a finisher than Waiters is, and I think as a shooter, he might even be better. J.R. Smith is just extremely streaky, but if you can get him on an island where he just has to kind of plan himself and take a shot, I mean, J.R. Smith can be an effective player.
He's, you know, he's just like Swaggy P, and he's going to shoot 15 shots no matter what.
Yes.
You just hope a good half of them.
You know who he reminds me of a little bit, but he's not as, I mean, he's more athletic than he ever was, but he reminds me of Eddie House. Eddie House is a little like that.
Yeah, well, Eddie House, that's all he did was just shoot threes. He knew his role.
Yeah, and JR, I think, is in a point where he does know what he has.
Well, I think we've said that how many years now? Okay, he knows his role. He's just going to shoot. No, I want to be a starter.
We've used this term before. I think I used it with Monte Ellis in Dallas. I think JR's on his best basketball behavior, you know, where it's like, I want to be the guy that everybody relies on. I don't want to be that bad player anymore. I want to do good things, you know. It's almost like you're auditioning. I don't know if he's auditioning for a new contract because he's still got 2 years left, but it just seems like JR's just trying to savor his career by at least playing his best team ball.
And I don't know, maybe that or just the antics don't fly. And, you know, now that LeBron is there and there's veterans, you can't just, you know, go pop it off your mouth.
Yeah, it's not like LeBron's been, you know, sitting away and doing nothing. I mean, he's been absolutely on a tear, too. That's a big part of it as well.
Yeah, like the team is hot. They're hot at the right time. They could get rest. They're going to, you know, it's It's not, you know, for the overreactors, it's not, Cleveland is now peaking at the right time.
Yeah, the loss at Indiana was a little stunning because they had just come off a big blowout win at home against the Clippers, where the Clippers got like 89 technical fouls, all at the hands of, mostly at the hands of one female referee that Chris Paul criticized. He got fined $25,000 for doing that one, I believe rightfully so. What did you think of that one, just to...
They're making a, oh, it's a woman referee. It's, I don't think that's the, you know, there's been, I remember Violet Palmer back, you know.
Violet Palmer is a great referee. I've had games where I've never really noticed her. You know?
She was horrible when she first started. And I remember, you know, reading the message boards, people get, I'm like, it doesn't matter that she's a woman. Everybody.
The referees are bad. Steve Zabby's bad.
Once you start off, you're going to be terrible because you're still, you know, it's a lot faster than anything you've ref before.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I didn't really see what happened, but it just seems like he, you know, everybody has that one ref that gets under their skin. And I just think Chris Paul just, that's just, you know, one bad game for him.
Yeah, I think he picked the wrong one to get under his skin, though, the female referee.
Yeah,
I
mean, but that's just trying to make a story of it. It'll die down in a week when something else happens.
But following that Thursday night game on TNT, we had Cleveland go to Indiana. They blew their winning streak there. It was just a game where Indiana was just playing great. And even though LeBron had great numbers, their shooting percentage was down, and they just weren't feeling it that day, and the streak ended. But right now they're sitting at 31-21 as we speak. They're actually a half game behind Chicago. So that storyline that you and I talked about and that everybody else talked about before the season started about the Central Division at the top with Chicago and Cleveland, it's happening now. And guess what I also noticed? Washington has been on a little bit of a lull now, and they haven't really shaken it off. We talked about that last week. It's still going on. They lost 5 games in a row. And
well,
now
isn't Beal injured now, or he's having some lingering effects?
He's having some lingering effects. John Wall is playing really well. I just can't put my finger on what's wrong.
Pierce seems to be running out of steam. Mm-hmm. Just looking at his numbers, but that's why I thought, I'm like, oh, Beal must be hampered by something, because that explains the lull, because that's your shooting there, but
Chicago and Cleveland is 3.5 games away from Toronto. Chicago is 3 games away from Toronto, and Washington, as we speak, 2.5 games. Toronto kind of peaked again when DeMar DeRozan came back into the fold. They had a great win on Friday night against the Clippers. Poor Clippers. They've been like, they've just been on the receiving end of some whoopings for the last couple of days. But it's starting to get interesting. I don't know if any of them are going to catch Atlanta. Even if Atlanta goes like 500 down the stretch, they're still going to win 56 games. So I don't know if anyone's going to catch them at this point. I think they're going to basically win over the first seed, barring a complete meltdown after the All-Star break. Do you agree?
I agree. It will take a complete meltdown or a traumatic injury to, I don't even know who. Mm-hmm. Maybe Kyle Korver? Because that's... He seems to be the lifeblood of that team for some unknown reason.
There was some injury I just noticed. There was one to Thabo Sefolosha. And
he hasn't done anything.
Yeah, he's just a defender. You know,
yeah, they have your boy Damari Carroll in there.
Damari Carroll had a little bit of an injury, but I don't think that's going to last. Did you like the fact that all 5 guys were named the Eastern Conference Player of the Month? I thought that was kind of hammy.
It was extremely hammy, especially if
That means Damari Carroll was the Eastern is the player.
Exactly. And
really,
at one point, you know, we had that, you know, a couple episodes back about how good is he? Is he underrated? You know, if you're the 5th best guy on the floor and your team's tearing it up, by default, you're, you know, seeing some of that shine come down upon you. But
yeah,
there's no reason him or no, it's that's just hammy, and I don't really understand it.
Yeah, it's like we were talking about, you know, Pete Carroll in the NBA when you make a play at the when you call a play at the end, good coach, bad coach. Like the Clippers went undefeated in the month of December in 2012. Does that make Vinny Del Negro a great coach all of a sudden?
He's the coach of the, but you make him coach of the year for that one.
Yeah, you know, I mean, and now obviously the Hawks have been a lot more consistent than that. Their month of December was almost as good. They lost a whopping 2 games, and so far in February they only lost once. And they had, I don't know if you saw it, but we previewed it in the previous podcast, but they had a great game with the Golden State Warriors in Atlanta, finished in the high 100s. So I was very, well, not high 100, but what I mean by that, like in the 120s.
Oh, it was 124 to 116.
Fantastic game.
Nobody played defense.
Well, The Hawks tried, and they got some stops down the stretch. The Golden State could not stop the Hawks.
Yeah, the only thing I took away from that game is they shot a combined 63 pointers.
Mm-hmm.
That's way too much. And then Atlanta hit like 50% at least. So they were just hitting everything.
Well, they shoot 50% on everything, and they never miss from the free throw line. And they're one of the highest assist mark teams in the league. So they move the ball well, they make all their open shots, and they make their free throws if they get to the foul line. So they're very. Did you feel like you watched the two best teams in the NBA?
No, not really. I just felt like I was watching an all-star game where everyone's just sort of shooting around. There was a big foul discrepancy, too, if I recall. Like, mm-hmm. Atlanta kept getting to the line. I'm like, how? Like, you got to call it even, at least. And I don't know. It didn't seem too even.
Yeah. It
was the Atlanta home court. It was like a home court all-star game where you're just shooting threes and Draymond Green's like rebounding everything.
But we got to give credit to that Atlanta fan base, at least for once in our lives. They're getting their caca. They're getting their caca on, you know?
Yes, they showed up for their one game for the year, and they'll be back to empty arenas when they host Brooklyn or whoever gets the 8th seed.
Just like Phillips equipment. Really fancy, but empty inside. So, you know, we just talked, obviously, this whole thing started with Cleveland, but really it turned into a little exploration of the Eastern Conference as we're nearing the top, even though we think Atlanta is pretty safe at this point, but it's getting really interesting between the 2 seed and the 5 seed. I think there's a pretty clear cutoff there with Milwaukee. We talked about the 8 seed in the Eastern Conference. I was actually hoping that we would talk about both conferences, but we got so deep into the Eastern Conference because there's so many guys or so many teams that are kind of like, it seems like they're sort of wasting away, but if you really stare it down, they still have a chance to get in there. Teams like Indiana, Boston, I don't know how.
Well, that's the thing is you're like, well, Cleveland had an off game against Indiana. Oh, Indiana's fighting for the 8 seed now. All these teams, you know, they had an off game against Detroit.
That's true. There's a little beam of light there.
They're sneaking in.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. And now the Western Conference is a little different, but it's a similar storyline, is that the 8 seed is really where the fight is. I'll explain the Western Conference standings right now. Golden State is at 40-9. Memphis, who's really looked better with the Jeff Green trade. I mean, they were good as it was, but when Jeff Green got added, they got even better. They're at 37-13.
Yeah, no, Jeff Green trade. I didn't know there was an opening for me there. Portland is basically, like I said before, Portland's kicking themselves. They didn't do anything because they could have used him too.
Yeah, Portland's at 34-17 at the 4 seed. They're fun to watch, even though it feels like Damian Lillard is sort of. It looks like he's sort of burning out. I feel like the All-Star break is a perfect time for him because it feels like he needs just a little bit of a blow because he's been working extra hard for the last few games. They got Robin Lopez back as well.
Wow, that changes everything. Well, Hall of Famer Robin Lopez.
It's like Mozgov in Cleveland. You need that big in there to kind of offset all the other guys from taking advantage of you in the paint, even if it's not the biggest name. So
yeah.
Dwight Howard's out, but Houston's still kind of rocketing up, and they're at 35-15 as a 3 seed. Dallas is 35-18. I mean, these teams between Houston, Portland, Dallas, the Clippers, and the San Antonio Spurs, they're all within 3 games of one another. That's the 3 seed to the 7 seed.
Well, Dallas is, you know, they're hurting by the Rondo injury. Mm-hmm. Houston, okay, you lose Dwight Howard, but you have Josh Smith, so you play sort of small ball.
Yeah, they play small as it is. They take so many threes.
Yeah, and you just, you know, as long as you have Harden, you're just riding him, and they obviously need to make a trade for a point guard, I think, still.
Yeah. We talked about the Clippers and their bad losses against good teams, though.
The Clippers are just a tough team to peg because some nights they look at the best team in the league, and some nights they just look horrible. And Blake Griffin's out with a staph infection for a week or two.
Oh, CM Punk is ruining the day of that. Blake Griffin got a staph infection.
It's just, I don't know. That team is just very, other than we, you know, Doc Rivers is a horrible GM.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that team is like, are they built to win? Are they built to just get in?
They're built for now, but they're not built for right now is the weird thing. It's not a team that can win a title right now, but they're trying to. If that makes any sense.
I know, but at some point, it's just like, do they, if they just keep holding off for too long, do they pass the prime almost?
Mm-hmm. I get your point. Yeah, I mean, like, Chris Paul is great, but he can't go that long. You know, sooner or later, he's going to slow down, especially with his size. San Antonio, I think, are doing just fine. You know, I mean, I don't think they're happy as a 7 seed, but I feel like they're gonna start chugging it out pretty soon. Then it gets interesting. The 8 seed is the Phoenix Suns. They're still winning games at home. Their home record is it's really not that great, to be honest with you. It's 16-10, but they've looked better recently. Their offense is really good. You and I don't talk about the Phoenix Suns that much, so let's just kind of explore them a little bit before we get to the other teams that are fighting for an 8 seed. What do you think about that? I call them the 1-2-3 punch because you got number one is Goran Dragic, number two is Bledsoe, and number three is Isaiah Thomas, who comes off the bench. How do you like that so far with the Morris twins inside?
The Morris twins are... they don't really provide much, which is why they had to sort of pick up Brandon Wright for a little from the bench, because you need something, and you have the 1-2-3 punch, and then Gerald Green is, you know, the fourth in that.
Yeah, he's the slasher. He's the key small forward. You know,
they just, you know, I like Alex Len.
Mm-hmm.
He's been, you know, with the exception of just being injured all the time, he's coming.
PJ Tucker is a steady hand, but he's not like a blow away great player.
No, I just think they're too small in the end to compete. As good as Dragic and Bledsoe are, you need something more than the Morrises, I think.
Yeah, it does feel like the star power is missing. It does, even though the game plan is pretty sound and it's unconventional, but it works.
It works. I think they're sort of overachieving by everyone's standards. I think it was sort of a 1 year thing, and here they are again, rattling around the eighth place. And I still think they might fall a half game short like last year. But it's just it seems to be one piece missing, and you can't get it with two guards who are essentially the same person.
Well, the rumor was last season going into free agency, they have a lot of cap room, because before the Bledsoe deal got inked, they didn't really – I mean, they had him under a rookie deal. So the rumor was that they were trying to sign LeBron James. And I don't know if LeBron was really that interested, but it was just the fact that they actually did have the cap room to do it. You know, they also had the cap room to try to sign Kobe Bryant or Steve Nash in 2004, and Kobe shunned them, and Steve Nash went to Phoenix, and that changed everything. But with Phoenix, I do agree with you about the star power. It feels like they just don't have that one go-to guy. Do you like the fact that Isaiah Thomas comes off the bench and it's Goran and Eric Bledsoe instead? Because I like what Isaiah Thomas gives them, and I don't know if they use him enough.
I think he's limited as compared to Bledsoe and Dragic. Thomas just doesn't have the size, I think, to constantly be in it every day.
Yeah, and he's more of a volume scorer, so it's more helpful with Bledsoe and Dragic because they're ball handlers. They're dominant two guards to me, but they're also good at sharing the ball when they need to. So ball movement's not a problem for those two. With Isaiah Thomas, he's looking to shoot.
Yeah, that's the thing, is he's a two in a one body. I don't know, they're all shooting guards.
Mm-hmm.
You could even say Gerald Green is 1-2, as opposed he's more of a 2 than a 3. And it's just, you know, they also have cap room next year, but Dragic is going to opt out of his deal and get a ton more money.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what the Brandon Wright thing was a nice little fill for the bench, but because all they had is just, you know.
They had Miles Plumlee.
Oh, wow. They're trying to get rid of him, but nobody wants him. He's been on the block. It's just, you know, you have P.J. Tucker.
Bring him back to Brooklyn and play with Mason.
You have P.J. Tucker and you know, Marcus Morris is your – I don't know.
They got Archie. They have Archie Goodwin. They have the guy who's been in the D-League a little bit, T.J. Warren. Outside of that, really not much.
Yeah, they don't have much, and that's the thing, is they're just missing It's just like, oh, we're going to sign all these guards. Okay, you have them. Well, what are you going to do now? Well, we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to put it, but it's just you're missing something.
Yeah, it's fascinating, though, because you got Golden State with, you know, Thompson. Because we're just talking about the teams that are in the playoffs. You know, Klay Thompson, Steph Curry, awesome. Memphis, Marc Gasol, Z-Bo. Houston, James Harden, Dwight Howard. Portland, Damian Lillard, LaMarcus Aldridge. Dallas, Monte Ellis, I guess, and Dirk Nowitzki. LA Clippers, you got Chris Paul, Blake Griffin, Doc Rivers. San Antonio, all that history. And then you got the Phoenix Suns, and they're just kind of like there. And you're like...
Well, that's the thing, is they're not... You know, oh, Bledsoe's good. Well, he's not Lillard. Mm-hmm. Oh, Dragic is good. Well, he's no Klay Thompson. And just every team you put him up against, well, he's not that person.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just sort of like second class syndrome. It's just they're exciting, but they're just not thrilling. And the Morris twins just suck out everything.
They're almost gimmicky. I almost want to call them a gimmick, but they're a really good gimmick if that's the case, because they're still winning games. They're 6 games over .500. They're not firmly in the 8th spot, and that's where we're going to be moving on, because Phoenix, we talked about, doesn't really have a superstar, but the teams that are chasing them, because after that, there's no other teams. Denver, Utah, Sacramento Kings, LA Lakers, Timberwolves, see you later. But the other ones have superstars in their tow. The first one we'll hit on is Oklahoma City, and they sit now at .500. Russell Westbrook has been absolutely fucking destroying people. Well, have you been watching him lately?
He's been on fire, but the team hasn't.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing, is he's been just sort of willing them to dragging them along, because Durant hasn't really taken over yet.
That's what I was going to ask you. Do you think something's wrong with Durant and it's not necessarily physical?
No, I think he's just sort of pacing himself. Every time you come back from, like, a scary injury, you're not going to, you know, you're going to be slow for a little bit.
You're not going to go full tilt.
It's just, I came back for Christmas. Let me just make it to All-Star break.
Mm-hmm.
Have a nice week off. Then, okay, here's phase two. And it's just sort of like he just seems to sort of be at, like, 80%-ish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's almost like Shaq, and we talked about this a million times, like when Shaq was with the Lakers, it felt like he was kind of taking the regular season off a lot. And I don't want to say that Kevin Durant is loafing it, because Kevin Durant's a fierce competitor. He really is. Now, does that necessarily mean, like, the results are going to show that he's going to wind up on top because he competes a lot harder than some of the other star players? Not necessarily, because he's come up short a lot of times already in his career, but it does feel a little bit like he's taking it easy, like you're saying.
He's taking it easy, and then, okay, they make the trade. They get Dion, who's just, you know, it's just, you know, he'll just shoot. He's not really being an all-star. They've sort of ruined Reggie Jackson. Reggie Jackson.
He's going to be a restricted free agent, very likely to not come back if he gets...
Well, who's going to be probably gone in the next few weeks.
True.
They've sort of soured that. Oh, they signed Nick Collison, who provides a ton? That's just more of a PR thing. It's just, you know, Serge Ibaka, his numbers are up, but I don't see him as the same guy.
His numbers are up because when Durant was out, he had to take more shots.
He had to take more shots, but his numbers are still up now. It's mm-hmm. not like, okay, Durant's back, he's going back to his usual, you know, 6 points and 10 boards. He's mm-hmm. still, he doesn't, I don't know. And that without outside hand, you know, Adams, I haven't seen too much progression from him.
Nah, he's the same as what I saw his rookie year. Their defense is really good. If you just look at the numbers, but offensively, 99.5 points a game. That's like either middle of the pack or one of the worst in the league. That's not going to cut it.
Well, they're playing like a .500 team in the end.
They are. They're not. It's, you know, we were waiting, saying, oh well, they're going to play great, even though they got a lot of catching up to do, and they did have catching up to do when Durant came back. And when Russell Westbrook came back from his injury, but it doesn't feel like they're playing better than the record shows. They're playing like a .500 team. It's like Bill Parcells said, you are what your record says you are. And Oklahoma City looks like a .500 team. They look like the 10th best team in the Western Conference. And that's where the problem lies going forward with Durant, and whether or not he wants to stick around.
Well, that's 2 years from now. Who cares about what happens in 2016?
Mm-hmm.
That's just the only year that matters is this year. And if you keep asking him, it'll be like a Carmelo situation where he's just like, okay, I've had enough of it.
Yeah, I can't it turns into an embargo. Like, I'm not answering any questions.
Yeah, him. Yeah. Same thing with Kevin Love. It's, well, what are you gonna do in 2 years? What are you like? Okay, now you guys have just sort of ruined it for me.
Mm-hmm.
I can't just go out and play. Well, what is he gonna do? Well, he's gonna get his $40 million wherever he's gonna go. He has every team will have cap room.
Yes, ample cap room thanks to the new salary cap.
So he could literally pick one of any team in the league.
Yeah.
It's so...
They should just all have a rose. Like, all the GMs should just have a rose. And we should just have another decision.
Oh, he'll go here. But the thing is, they're all going to change places. I doubt it's going to probably be chaos with this. There's going to be bad signings, and we got to sign him first. And it's hopefully things get straightened out before then. But why are we concerned about what happens? The team will be okay. What, they're gonna be terrible without him? So you're gonna try to drive him away? Like, why don't you sign now?
Mm-hmm.
Like, just get your team into the playoffs first before you start bitching about, well, what are you gonna do in 2 years?
Yeah, well, that was a little bit of talk when he went to DC, because they were really, really heavy on that one with well, will he go back to DC and play for someone? Whatever. But we're talking about a guy who's already getting paid big bucks and he's gonna get another fat contract. This one is a team that has a guy that isn't getting paid big bucks yet, but is very, very soon to be, and that's Anthony Davis with the New Orleans Pelicans. Now, Oklahoma City and New Orleans had back-to-back home-and-home games. Oklahoma City won the first one big. Russell Westbrook scored 45. Next game was a thriller. That was in Oklahoma City on Friday night. Russell Westbrook tied his career high again the next night with 45 more points, but Anthony Davis scored 40. Tyreek Evans got a triple-double, and Anthony Davis, well, first of all, there was just a lot of really crazy antics. If anybody wants to watch it, please check out the highlights of the fourth quarter of the Pelicans-Thunder game, because it was a thriller. It was a great, great game. No bullshit. And Russell Westbrook got fouled on a three by Quincy Pondexter. Sunk all three free throws. Tied the game. With a second to go, Anthony Davis double pumped a three-pointer with Durant guarding him and sunk it to win the game. Did you watch this?
I saw the final play, and I was like, oh, he's going to be happy. can I say it's a fluke shot to an extent?
He's made, well, that's his first three of the year, but he's got great stroke. He's got
course.
A good natural shooting hand.
He's an all-star here. He's the Hall of Famer, according to you. And well, now, well, what's up with him now? He's with his shoulder and all?
What happened is the next night they played against the Chicago Bulls. Early in the game, he went up for an alley-oop. I don't know who got – somebody kind of undercut him on the alley-oop. So when he was hanging after the dunk, he lost grip, and he fell on his shoulder. Now, he had already had some, you know, some of that kind of – I don't know how – I can't really describe what that is. I've seen it with Derrick Rose, that kind of black tape that they put on their muscles to kind of – I don't know what it's supposed to do for him, but – Davis already had some like tape on his other shoulder. Then he hurt the other one. So they ruled it right now as a shoulder contusion. They don't really have an official diagnosis yet. I would have to bet that he'll be out for at least this game and then the game coming up for before we head to the All-Star break. Will he play in the All-Star game is going to be interesting. Because it's his first time as a starter, I will say that he will. But he got injured, and without Davis, lo and behold, they got blown out.
Yep, that's that's sort of the microcosm for your Hornet or Pelicans.
Mm-hmm, almost there.
you're just riding on him, and it's just injuries. The team just can't stay healthy. When somebody comes back, somebody else goes out.
Yeah, does it feel like a one-man show to you, watching as a casual viewer?
Yes, because how many games, like, there should be some graphic. How many games have Gordon, Evans, and Holiday played together?
Very few. Less than 20.
There's always somebody out, and it's just like, well, why am I seeing Jimmer Fredette in again? Oh, it's because they have no bench, and one of their three guys is out, and it's just they have nobody. Your team has no bench, and you've sunk all this money into Eric Gordon and Tyreek, and they're just not playing, can't be on the court together because always somebody's out. Mm-hmm. It's just, it must be frustrating.
It is. I mean, I've voiced my frustrations a million times over with New Orleans Pelicans and why I think Monty Williams is just a bad coach. I really believe
that. But no, your frustration's with the coach, and it's just like, I would be more frustrated with just the amount of injuries and...
Well, they've had rotten luck for years. You know, even Davis has had injuries. You know, it's not like Davis has had a clean season every season. I think he got shut down late in the year last year. Ryan Anderson, I mean, he was barely there last year. Eric Gordon had a shoulder injury for quite a long time. I thought they played a little bit better than without him than I thought they would. But now Gordon's playing a lot. I'll say this. Gordon's playing better now than I've ever seen him play for the New Orleans Pelicans. And Tyreek Evans does really stupid things late in games, because he's so dead set on handling the ball and dominating the ball. But he's had some really great games over the last couple of weeks. And it does feel like things are turning upwards. I'll put it this way, Adam. They're winning more games than they're losing games.
Yeah, but okay, I will counteract with this. If I see Luke Babbitt starting 20 games throughout the year, I'm going to be like, what is going on?
Yeah, well, what's going on is that they don't have an owner. Or at least an owner with the right mind. So it's all on Demps and Dell Demps, the general manager, just to confirm that. And it's really up to them and Monty to really make the right decisions of, okay, who are we going to come in and bring in to help us out? The trade deadline, I don't think they really have a lot of room to move, because they've put so much money in on Evans. They put a lot of money in on Eric Gordon already. And then you got Drew Holiday, who's been out for quite a long time, and I don't think he's going to be coming back because I think he had another stress fracture. So it's really all on what we have. You have what you have. I can see him making one move. They already made one with Quincy Pondexter, dumping Austin Rivers. That was extremely smart. And I don't know. Do you see them making one more move?
They'd have to get rid of somebody. You have to get rid of Tyreek or Eric Gordon or somebody. Would have to take them.
I think they need a small forward. Like, if they could get, say, I'm just playing around here, like Wilson Chandler. Like, that could help. You know, I think that would be a nice fit. But what would they have to give up to bring in Chandler? Well, you might have to give up an injured Drew Holiday and... I mean, what else are they going to want? What else would the Nuggets ask for? That's just one hypothesis. There's other players.
You'd have to start offering draft picks. And do they even have theirs this year?
The one coming up, yes. They lost the one from the previous year.
Yeah, I know that, but it just seems like they're one of those teams that always just trades them away or draft somebody stupid.
They traded the future to get Evans and Holiday, and I didn't like it. And, I mean, it's not like Nerlens Noel is making me blush, but it's one of those situations where, and we talked about this on a previous show, is like, you know, where do you want to go from here? Do you want to win now, or do you want to wait another 2 years and hope that the fans don't mutiny? And they said, we want to win now.
Now it makes sense. They wanted to win now when the owner had a mind. Now, apparently, you know, his kids are suing him and everything.
Is that a big national thing? I'm here in New Orleans in the bubble, in under the dome, as I guess you could call it. No, is that a big story out in the nation?
No, not really. I only know that due to my Saints fandom.
Oh, okay.
But it's just, like, I don't really know. It's not a big story, and it seems
it's
like
it's a really fascinating story. If anybody wants to get into it, about Tom Benson, basically his wife wrote. His daughter. I mean, it's not his wife's daughter. You know, he married three times, and this wife is basically wrote Rita Benson LeBlanc, who was one of the daughters, out of the will. So basically, Gail, the wife, is going to be running the show when Tom Benson dies, and it's already gone into court litigation. There's already been videotape of some of the court proceedings, and it's getting. There's another daughter involved that was never really that hands-on with the Saints organization, and it's getting extremely messy, and I don't know how it's going to end. It's not Donald Sterling kind of dramatic, but it's starting to get a little seedy.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm like. The NFL is just like, I don't know, it seems like a non-issue to us, and the NBA seems to be saying the exact same thing.
Well, Roger Goodell, no surprise, said, you know, oh, Tom Benson is, we fully have confidence in him. Well, of course you fucking do. Because you don't care about anything.
I know he's not trustworthy, but it's just, I don't know, it just seems like it's just greedy kids who are just like, well, we want money now.
Well, a greedy wife, too.
Over. Yeah.
A greedy wife wanting all the power and trying to write Rita out of the mix. It's interesting. I don't know if anybody listening to the podcast even cares. But basically, New Orleans Pelicans, despite all the ownership troubles, is still doing a lot better than they did when the season began. They are a game and a half ahead of Oklahoma City. Now, here's where we're going to finish this topic. And we'll just go ahead and try to make a decision right now. Which team do you think is going to make it out of these three? Which one is the most likely to sit in that 8 seed? And do you think it'll stay that way to the end?
I think it'll be close to the end, because at no point has Oklahoma City, who rightfully probably should be in the 8 seed, if not higher, have sort of been lackadaisical. But I still say, you know, Oklahoma City will be the team. Phoenix will be a half game out. New Orleans will crap out like they usually do.
Oh, you're killing me, dude. but yeah, it is weird to imagine a playoffs without the Oklahoma City Thunder now. So I get your point there. I think that's a valid point. I would love to see Anthony Davis be that guy that steps up. And even, I'm going to tell you this too, even as an 8 seed, I would not want to play the Pelicans because of Anthony Davis.
Well, no, because you're playing Golden State of all teams. If they're the 7th seed, like Memphis, Houston, Portland, Dallas, Clippers, they all have something, a knock on them. But Golden State seems to be kind of riding high right now. But it just comes down to, like, Oklahoma City, like, playoff teams know how to get back in the playoffs. Young, inexperienced teams find ways to falter. And I just don't – I just think, you know, Oklahoma City could overcome a three-game deficit, probably since they have to play each other, you know, at least once.
Okay, now we were talking about, well, how can you get help if you don't have it in the trade deadline? Well, the one way you can do it is get guys on minimum contracts, and there's different ways in which you can do that. One of the ways that a lot of teams use, even though a lot of times they don't really expect much from the players, is call-ups from the NBA Developmental League, the NBA D League, which we really haven't talked about that much on this podcast. We've talked about one-and-doners. We've talked about, you know, NBA draft picks. We've talked about other things. But we really haven't really delved into the NBA Developmental League. When was the first time you ever heard of the NBA Developmental League?
I remember when it came out. I remember Mickey Moore was, like, the all-star.
Mickey Moore, yeah.
Yeah, Mikey Moore, every year he was up. Oh, he's too good to be in the D-League. Okay, somebody called him up. He's at the end of the season. Up, oh, back in the D-League. Up, oh, back up again. Oh, do you know Mikey Moore has like 10 snakes? Okay, here's random. And then, you know, Chris Anderson put him on the map. He was the first, I think, real big success story of, you know, he could come from there. And now it's just, they're all interchangeable.
Let me give you the first call-ups in the NBA Developmental League in 2001, 2002. Chris Birdman Anderson, who's like one of the Hall of Fame. He's like, if there's an NBA D League Hall of Fame, like, you know, they have the Naismith Memorial Hall of Fame in, I'm drawing a blank. Is it in Springfield?
Yep.
Okay. Well, they need to put the Developmental League in, like, Bangor, Maine. But yeah, this guy's like a D-League Hall of Famer. Chris Anderson, Jason Hart, who I remember from Syracuse, Anthony Johnson, Rusty LaRue, Tremaine Foulkes, never heard of him, Isaac Fontaine, and I remember him, Ansu Cisse, and then Omar Cook from St. John's.
I remember Omar Cook. I remember, I remember Jamario Moon went to the Raptors. Rafer skipped to my Lou. Alston.
Yes. Rafer Alston was one of the guys.
Smush Parker?
Smush
for
Parker.
The Lakers?
I remember him.
Ime Udoka, I remember because we mentioned him on the Obscure Rings
podcast.
He's a
key assistant coach now for the San Antonio Spurs. The one guy who was like the first one to really be an impact player in the playoffs from the D League, I remember, was Devin Brown. Because he came from UTEP, and he played on the San Antonio Spurs D-League affiliate. and he got put in the postseason roster, and there was a key game. It's actually the Derek Fisher game when he hit the shot with 0.4 left. The guy who was really making plays for the Spurs down the stretch was, of all people, Devin Brown, because he was just hot that day. It's really no other way to explain it. And you know, sometimes you just get inspiration in the weirdest of places. We could look at some of these other ones. James White, C.J. Watson, Alan Anderson, Chuck Hayes, John Lucas III, Matt Carroll, who I remember played for a long time with the Charlotte Bobcats at the time. Von Wafer. You remember Von Wafer with the Houston Rockets and the Boston Celtics?
Yep.
Yeah, he was decent. I mean,
he was a shooter who had a major attitude problem.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know. Basically, it became like an image perception. First, when it started, it was so new. Oh, you got sent down there. That's horrible. That's where, you know.
Oh, yeah. It had a scarlet letter to it.
Like, you know, when
the Patrick League.
Yeah, when Patrick O'Brien gets sent down there and all, like, you know.
It was almost like punishment.
Yeah.
Like, you got suspended for weed, so we're sending you to the D League, and you could stay there for 2 months and wallow, you know?
Yeah, and then I think, like, maybe, what was it, Linsanity, like, 4 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe 4 or 5 years ago, you started to get players, okay, go down there for a week or two. Well, we don't have minutes here.
There's assignments, which is when you get assigned from the main roster and go, I guess the better way to put it is sent down, if you really, I mean, the minor leagues, we see this all the time, Major League Baseball. This is obviously the NBA's minor leagues. When they first started it, like we were just saying, it was something that players really weren't terribly fond of because the coaching wasn't that good. The organization wasn't that good. All the teams were moving around like crazy. Like back then we had the Mobile Revelers, the Fayetteville Patriots, the Columbus River Dragons, the Asheville Altitude. None of those teams are around anymore. So when they first started it, they only had 29 people assigned in the 2005-2006 season being sent down. As of last year, there were 62 players that were sent down. So now it's almost like rookies or players that are trying to play through injuries. Now getting to the D League is actually a good thing because you're able to get more playing time. And also, this is the key. As the D League has sort of matured, the coaches have gotten better. The communication between the affiliate organization, the main organization that owns that D League, and the D League team, the communication's a lot better. So players are much more in tune to what the coach wants when they get called back up. If that makes any sense.
Well, now it's just like you get sent down for a Friday game, you get called back up for Saturday. And it's changed, you know, from, you know, the 8 teams with, I remember the Charleston Low Gators and the Roanoke Dazzle.
The Roanoke Dazzle.
You know, here's 7 or 8 teams, send them down, we don't care. Now, at least half the teams have their own minor league affiliate.
Yes, that was the key. They started, all the teams started saying, okay, we need to get in on this. And they started having parents. I'll explain them all here. Austin, they were used to be called the Austin Toros, but they're the Austin Spurs. The Spurs own them. The Cavaliers own the Canton Charge. The Magic own the Erie Bayhawks. The Pistons have the Grand Rapids Drive. The Grizzlies have the Iowa Energy. The Iowa Energy is actually one of the kind of like, as stupid as this to say, one of the forefathers of the D-League. They were around from the beginning. Your Celtics, the Maine Red Claws. We talked about them before. The Sacramento Kings have the Reno Bighorns, who I actually just saw play in a D-League showcase game about 2 weeks ago against the Rio Grande Valley Vipers, and they shot a million three-pointers. Have you watched a lot of the D-League games?
This year, no, but I remember I watched a few Vipers games online.
Oh, my God, it's so much fun. They have a very – I mean, Daryl Morey is, you know, he's like one of the kind of smartest guy in the rooms type GMs, and – A lot of these coaches, they take these assistants or they take these kind of D3 coaches or kind of like off the wall minds, and they almost use the D League as like a mad science experiment. You know, it's almost like, you know, we'll never do this in the NBA because it'll never work. But let's just see if it works here. So Rio Grande Valley, he hired all these different coaches, and they have been absolutely like dead set on the idea you are going to take nothing but three pointers. No mid-range shots, all dunks, layups, and three-pointers. That's the way the NBA offense is, and we're going to put it on steroids in the D-League, and we're going to have all these players work on their shooting skills. And I think Rio Grande Valley averaged like 130 points a game last season.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. And they, it's just, I don't know, it's just, well, it's just weird to watch basketball and, you know, American basketball in front of like 20 people.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of disappointing.
And good players, too. Like, guys that were in college and they played in the NCAA tournament and they were stars, like Seth Curry when he played at Duke. And I'm drawing a blank on a couple of others, but if you really look at all these rosters, there's some really, really nice players that that are in the D-League right now and came through the D-League. And that's the most important part, is that the D-League isn't one of these things where you look at the rosters and the alumni and say, man, none of these guys really did much. There's a couple of players that went through the D-League that became really key players in for their teams down the road.
Well, that's what, you know, again, people are now choosing to stay at home as opposed to, they could all make money going to Europe, but it's like, I remember when I was in South Dakota, Bill Walker was on the Sky Force. I'm like, Bill Walker?
Mm-hmm.
And I think James Venardo was there for like a week or two before he got traded. And
yeah, well, one of the guys, I don't know if he played for the Sky Force, because he was actually, he actually got a workout with the Memphis Grizzlies, but I think a guy that played for the Sky Force just this year and got called up, and this is why we're talking about the D-League, is Hassan Whiteside. Now, we made a little bit of a passing joke about Hassan Whiteside when we did our one-and-doneer list, because he was one of the one-and-doneers in 2010. He got picked in the second round by the Toronto Raptors. That went nowhere, and he bounced around for quite a couple of years. I don't know if he went international between then, but he tried out for the Grizzlies, didn't make the team. So he played for the Sioux Falls Sky Force, which is the Miami Heat's parent team. He got called up by the Heat. He didn't do much to start. And then in the month of January, it just exploded. Against Brooklyn Nets, 11 points, 10 rebounds. Against the Clippers in a win, 23 points, 16 rebounds. And then he had a game on national television against the Chicago Bulls where he had 14 points, 13 rebounds, and 12 blocks. Did you watch this game?
No, but I read the stat line and I was very, I don't think anyone was doubting his talent. It was, he had just,
oh, I was
major,
doubting his talent.
No, he was always a shot blocker, even coming out of Marshall. He was, he was in the top of the blocks in, you know, D1, but he just had an attitude problem. And that was, you know, the cautionary tale of these kids are too young, thinking they're too good, and then you stop playing, you get traded, new coaches don't have any vested interest in you, they don't care, so you're just gone, and you have to find your groove, essentially. And yeah, he bounced, I think he was in like China and South America, and he had bounced internationally and then came back, and then maybe just Chris Anderson was like, look, if you want to stay here, you need to act like you want to stay. As for the hype, is it kind of a Linsanity thing again? Yeah.
A little bit, but Linsanity was another guy who went to the D-League. He was sent down by the Warriors, and I remember when Linsanity hit in New York, and one of the games that he had played in the D-League that season in 2012 was a game where he had like a triple-double, and NBA TV got the Linsanity fever too, and they would play that D-League game almost like a trading card. Like some collectible item, like, hey, look at this really weird game where Jeremy Lin went off on all these D-League guys, you know? And Hassan Whiteside is, it's not a phenomenon, you know, but there's definitely some context there, because it just shows how important it is for some of these guys to prove that they belong when the opportunity is there. I want to correct myself and say that he was actually drafted by the Sacramento Kings in 2010. That was the same year they drafted DeMarcus Cousins, number 4. So he didn't work out with the Kings, and he had to bounce around, like you said, but he made the most of his opportunity so far. Now, can he make that last? No. But does it give more credence to the NBA Developmental League and their players? Yes. Would you agree with that?
It gives credence. Will he... He could be a guy who's, you know, like Chris Anderson. That's definitely sort of his career he sort of wants to take. He's not going to be that all-star guy, but you could carve out a nice NBA career. And basically, I don't want to say the problem or the solution or anything. It's just worth noting, he's only 25 still.
Mm-hmm.
And look at all he's been through by the time he's 25 because he left when he was too early. And then didn't, you know, had a, maybe he found himself now, maybe this is just he's playing out of his mind. Who knows?
Yeah, and some of those, and you know, the D-League is weird. You know, we talk, you know, I obviously do Place to Be Nation's main event hosted by Scott Griscola with a you know, a ragtag of others, great guys. No, seriously, they're good guys. But you know, we talk a lot about NXT, and I don't know if you're familiar with NXT, but that is the
D-League,
their developmental territory. But it gets to a point, and I think Triple H mentioned this in an interview he had on a podcast with Steve Austin, is that NXT has established itself to a point where it's almost its own brand. It's almost its own – it almost has its own entity in terms of entertainment, in terms of viewership on the network because it's a streamed event. It's not on a cable show. And so you can kind of enjoy it for what it is. But it gets into that muddy situation of, well, at the end of the day – NXT is meant to develop your wrestlers, develop your talent. The NBA Developmental League does have a finals. It does have a playoffs. But at the end of the day, it's all about developing your talent. So if you want to call a guy up for your postseason roster, if you're in the middle of a final series in the NBA Developmental League, your pride says yes, but the organization says something different. So what I'm trying to say is, you know, I don't know if the WWE is doing a great job of making sure NXT differentiates itself as a developmental territory or a brand upon itself that you have to protect, almost like an asset. Do you feel like the NBA Developmental League will get to a point where it has its own history, it has its own legacy, where you don't want guys to move up because because the viewership is climbing and people are paying closer attention?
It'll never get that way because that must be the most frustrating thing of being a AAA coach or the AHL in hockey is your best player is going to be gone before the playoffs come and players keep coming, you know, week in and week out. And you have, you know, let's just say 8 or 9 guys who are on your roster, but then you're getting call downs. You're trying to make moves and it just must be frustrating just knowing, like, you know, 1 week we're at the top of the league. Oh, well, they've taken our guy who's now scoring 40 points, and now we're a basement team because we have nobody else.
And there are GMs for these D-League teams, but they're usually assistant GMs or directors of scouting for the main organization.
Correct.
So it's kind of like while the season's going on, when you're not doing your scouting, when you're not looking at any college guys, or, you know, there's just – you need some kind of time to waste, then you move on down and you work on the developmental league side of things with the team. And so you could have somebody to go back to and say, okay, what did you see out of the D-League? And, you know, for example, Greg Popovich says, hey, Jacques Vaughn, who I think worked in the D-League, what did you see? Well, this Danny Green guy is really good. And I think somebody's got to give him a chance. Well, he signed Danny Green, and look what happened to him. And he's one of the key guys. Chris Anderson, Birdman, he's one of them too. Another guy who was really good in the D-League was Will Bynum. Garrett Temple from LSU, he's a really good one. Gerald Green, like you had mentioned, one of your best friends. And Sean Livingston, you know, he's a guy that had to go back to the D-League to start over. So there's a few good ones. Let me mention just a few before we get out of here, because they have a really cool one on the website, dleague.nba.com, and they just started it this year, I think, called Prospect Watch, where they kind of rank guys that haven't been called up yet. And there have already been so far 25 call-ups. There were 37 last year. So, and just to put that into perspective, when they first did the D-League in 2001-2002, there were 8 call-ups. Now there are 25 so far this season, and we're not even at the All-Star break, which is pretty amazing. Here's the number one guy, Jordan Hamilton for the Texas Longhorns. Obviously, he's gotten some blow in the NBA. Do you think he can get another chance?
Yeah, they'll bounce around with 10-day contracts, and that's all they really, I think, are looking for at this point. It's just to get a step in as opposed to
– yeah.
I think – and now it's sort of like, okay, if we go overseas, you're sort of committed to that.
Yeah.
Because you don't hear many guys, like, going to Europe for 3 or 4 years and then coming back. It's
no, they
like,
usually last a couple months.
Yeah, it's like –
look at Emmanuel Mudiay. He got an injury, and hasn't played in China since.
No, I meant for, like, ex-NBAers who are committed to the Gerald Green. Okay, he played in Russia for 3 years, then he came back. But usually, like, most people are like, once you know you can make a living in Europe, they sort of just stay out there.
Yes.
And bounce around through all the
Especially Europe. If they have a visa, if they have a work visa overseas.
Yeah.
You know, guys like Nick Calathes, he was Greek. Now, he played at Florida, but he played for his Greek club because, obviously, he had Greek citizenship. So he said, okay, well, I'll just try to make this work. And then he comes back to the Memphis Grizzlies 4 years later with no hair. And he's a good help for them because he played in EuroLeague. Do you think – let's put it this way. Which one do you think is a better proving ground for some of these players trying to find their way? Euroball, D-League ball, or college ball?
Euroball is the best. Basically, you can't just toss out college because you can't go back to college. Once you commit, whether you're ready or not, you're done. You're out of college. So you can't say, I'm going to be better by staying a year. Because these kids, you know, from the one and done, you know, podcast, and those kids would have been none and done if there was a chance.
Yes, that's true.
So you can't equate college. I think NBA, I think the D-League will get them noticed more, but they'll be better in Europe, but then they don't get – you're sort of now stuck in that, well, he's going to go to Europe.
Yeah, and we've seen more guys – now, obviously, when you come from Europe, you get signed because you don't have to get drafted anymore. You're a free agent just like everybody else, even if you're an American that played overseas, like, say, a J.J. Barea or Anthony Parker, I remember. But say, for example, like – In the D-League, you can get drafted. You're eligible depending on your age and depending on how far removed from college you are. It helped out P.J. Harrison. I remember there was this one player named Mike Taylor that did it. Latavius Williams.
There was Glenn Rice. Giannis
Sanasis.
That team, you know, that Norvell Pell story from the Nun and Dunners.
Yeah, but they needed that D-League stint, not just because sometimes they prove themselves, like P.J. Harrison did, and then some guys like Latavius Williams, they prove, well, they still suck. But, you know, is that a good avenue for some of these players to try to get their foot in the door if, you know, say they get kicked out of school because of bad grades or bad behavior, or because they just didn't, or because maybe they're in junior college and they just want to prove themselves and they think that they can make one of these D-League rosters?
Well, yeah, because they're at home. You now have NBA front office people are now looking over, you know, they know your name. Mm-hmm. You have, you know, like you just said, the GM is usually like a scouting guy for the, they're always entwined. So if you make it to the D-League, you're now on the NBA's radar, your parent club. So you have a better way of getting noticed as opposed to be buried in the Spanish league where you're making, you know, a couple hundred grand as opposed to making 30 grand. See, but you're going to get noticed quicker here because you're on the radar as opposed to you're hoping some European scout, international scout, happens to find the one game you were at where you went off.
Yeah, like Giannis. Like Giannis didn't even go to the summer league. You know, Giannis, I think, is unique. He's unique in a lot of different ways, but I think his drafting and his scouting, it was so much more different than any I've ever seen. It was almost like Darko. Like, I'll never see anything like it where really only a handful of scouts saw him. He didn't play D-League. He didn't play Summer League. He didn't even go to the Nike Hoop Summit, which is a high school-based all-star game where the All-Americans play U.S. versus the world. He didn't even play in that. So almost no one saw him. It was like Bruno Caboclo was another.
I was just going to mention him in Detroit with Jonas Jerebko. He played
He was in Sweden, right?
He's from Sweden, but he was in like the Italian, like the C leagues. Mm-hmm. He was in like a really low league. And, you know, it's just the international scouting. And you just hope, like, and you're going to hope if you're an American, I'm going to go over there and they're going to find me. As opposed to just being here, your games are now streamed, the NBA is buying into it, it's safer.
And the other thing that I think is underrated about the D-League is that the players are really good. Like, some people would say, I don't know if they're as good as college players. Oh my God, they're a lot better than college players. A lot better. Now, are they better than EuroLeague players? I don't think so. Because the intensity in the EuroLeague is far different.
Well, you know, EuroLeague players are also people who, you know, you could go professional in Europe. It seems like when you're 16 or 17. Yeah. So
I'll correct myself. The best of the EuroLeague is better than the best of the D-League. I'll put it that way.
Oh, best by far. They're better than college because you know, like, remember when Jacksonville was terrible, the Jaguars were terrible, like, oh, well, Alabama could beat them. It's like, no.
Of course not.
Because the D-League is filled with all conference players, all, you know, you're Kentucky, okay, they're good, but you're playing with a guy who was all Patriot League, all WAC, all Big Sky.
Yeah.
You're playing with guys who are all-stars on their own team.
They were the best players on their own team. Exactly. I always make sure to tell that to people who watch NBA. I said, well, why is he taking that shot? You got to understand. These people have grown up all their lives being the best player on every team they played in until they got here. You know, so a lot of them have really irrational confidence that they can pull it off. And for some people like Lance Stephenson, it works out. And then for some people like, say, Greg Oden, it doesn't. You know, and it's just a matter of whether or not the timing is right and whether or not you have the want to. We're going to get away from the D-League, but I wanted to mention that because I thought the Hassan Whiteside thing was a pretty fun little story that continues in the NBA regular season. Is really the only fun thing to watch about the Miami Heat. If anybody wants to read a post, I got to promote this guy. His name is Nate Raby, and he has a blog called basketballblog.com, BASKETBAWLBLOG.com, and he had a great post about Hassan Whiteside. Really funny guy. I think people will be really interested in reading some of his stuff, along with the other writers that work with him. I actually am going to throw this back at Adam, because Adam has some questions that he wanted to give me.
Well, these are a couple of just NCAA softball questions. They're really – you'll be ashamed. You're like, really? This is what you can think of?
Okay.
First off is Syracuse. Now that they're ineligible for postseason – do you think they're sort of regretting their move to the ACC, because they're sort of just middling out right now? They had that good year last year. I don't really think Enos and whoever else they lost was really damaging to them, but they just don't look good.
They were going to make the tournament anyway because of how Rakeem Crispus was playing. But in terms of whether or not they regret going to the ACC, I think money-wise, they don't regret it because they're going to be making a lot more coin that way. But I think for the people that are really knee-deep in the basketball side of things at Syracuse, I think they deeply regretted the disintegration of the Big East as it was, because that was their home. They were one of the founders of the Big East the way it was. And for them to have to depart for the ACC, it makes them look bad, because they were one of the ones that spurned the Big East originally to go to the ACC along with Pittsburgh. And now they're in a situation where they have to climb out of a hole now that they have all these self-imposed bans, because of the fact that they're not going to be able to play in the postseason. That all goes back to a couple of discrepancies academically with Fab Mello and James Sutton.
Fab Mello.
Yeah. I mean, that happened in 2012, and I think it's almost like Miami with I forget the name of that booster that got him in trouble. I think his name was a Shapiro. But they're basically preparing themselves for the worst. And so they're saying, okay, we're going to take away our own postseason so that we can tack that onto our punishment after the fact.
Because, you know, they're 15-8 now. They're only 6-4 in the conference. Two more losses, you're now 15-10.
Yeah.
500.
If the tournament ended today, I would put them in the tournament. But if they continue losing, obviously no. But, you know, for James, my question for that whole situation is with Jim Boeheim. What happens with Boeheim? He's obviously looking at 1,000. He wants to get to 1,000 wins like Krzyzewski did. But he's still got another 37 wins to go. That's going to take at least two more seasons. He's going to have another season probably where they're going to be taking away a couple of his recruiting assessments because of the postseason ban and a couple of other punishments that are going to be levied on them by the NCAA. So, what is Jim Boeheim going to want to do? Is he going to want to stick around and have this limited amount of recruiting that he can get these guys while they're in a down period, or does he just walk away now? You know, but you don't want that Jim Calhoun scenario where you seem to be cutting and running, because that's what it felt like with Calhoun. It was almost like, well, I'm out of here, guys.
Yeah. That was just a question with Syracuse. I don't even mean to mention Creighton being in the Big East. Mm-hmm. They make DePaul look like an all-star team.
DePaul's bad. Creighton's just been awful without McDermott. The Big East is good, it's not nearly as good, obviously, as it was in years past when they had Syracuse and Georgetown and West Virginia and all those teams on top. That was an awesome conference, and I miss it dearly. I miss it already. It's only been gone 2 years.
Well, yeah, well, they had too many teams. I think that was their problem.
Like, oh, it was overflow.
They put seven teams in. Well, yeah, if you have six teams, not hard.
But it wasn't oversaturation because all the teams were still really good. It wasn't like in the ACC where teams get overhyped because they were good for so long. We see that right now in SEC football. But in the Big East, those teams legitimately were really fucking good. Like, all of them outside the – when you put them in the tournament, they were all tough. All of them were.
Are you serious? You're trying to tell me South Florida is good? You're trying
South
to defend
Florida got to the second round 1 year, right?
Oh, 1 year. South Florida, Seton Hall, and DePaul?
Mm-hmm.
If you just got rid of, like, four teams, that conference would have been, like, unbeatable. But you have just, like, I can't defend it with the bad teams were just always bad. And
well, it's cool you mentioned that because of the fact that, you know, in the Big East, it's always fun when you have teams at the top because sometimes when you get a new addition, like say Syracuse and Pittsburgh and Notre Dame and the ACC, and they're at the elite, they're really good, it makes the other teams try to catch up. It forces them to get better. In the SEC with Kentucky, I just haven't seen that yet. I don't feel like the teams are trying to get better. I almost feel like they're giving up. It's almost like defeatist. It's like, yes, they're better than us. We know this.
Well, with the SEC, it's just like, you know, Missouri has always been, you know, NIT borderline, and they didn't really provide much. And Texas A&M is sort of a surprise how well they're doing.
Yes, they went to double overtime with Kentucky. It was the closest game they've had.
But with the SEC, it's like you know what you're going to get. You always know South Carolina's a football school. Auburn's a football school. Vanderbilt sort of having a down year.
Yes.
Alabama's always terrible.
Yeah, Arkansas is having a good year. LSU is having a good year. Kentucky's going to be playing them on Tuesday night in Baton Rouge, so we'll be interested in seeing that after they kind of skirted by on a close one with Florida, including this incredible highlight dunk by Willie Cauley-Stein, who you'll probably see in the lottery coming up in the NBA draft this summer. I do also want to just make a mention of that, you know, our deepest condolences go out to the entire North Carolina Tar Heel family for the passing of Dean Smith at the age of 83. What a great, great coach and a great man.
I'm trying to toe the line sort of a bit. Yeah, he's probably arguably one of the best two or three coaches of all time.
Yeah, like if you did a Mount Rushmore, to me, it's so easy. Wooden, Bobby Knight, Krzyzewski, Dean Smith.
That's what I would.
I mean,
have that.
You could say Naismith, obviously. You could say Fog Allen. You could say Hank Iba. You could say Jim Calhoun. But I mean, really, when it comes to the four guys that, I mean, two of them were obviously the forefathers. But Smith is interesting because I don't know if he's really a forefather of college basketball as much as he was sort of a disciple of Fog Allen. You know, so he's kind of on that same line right after Wooden, but at the same time as Bobby Knight, you know.
Yeah, you know, again, 36 years coaching, he had one losing season.
His first season.
Yeah.
And he went 8-9 because of postseason, because they took off games because they were punishing the program for an academic scandal.
You know, yeah, so, you know, it's a shame, but again, he's 83. It's not like... He's not a spring chicken. This comes as no surprise.
Well, no. I mean, he was suffering from dementia for years, and people were saying it was Alzheimer's, but we never got that confirmed. When he was given the Medal of Freedom at the White House, I don't think he was even healthy enough to appear. So
yeah,
you could tell that it was going downhill for him. You would hear he would always write notes and send letters to the organization and. About a few years ago, he stopped sending the notes, and that's when it was kind of obvious, okay, something's going on here, and it doesn't look good.
But I think, you know, now with Coach K winning his milestone and, you know, Boeheim and all, it's good that his name is back. Sort of like, oh, remember how good he was? Yeah, he really was good. And
yeah.
You know, he was a tremendous mind.
Tremendous mind, great innovator, a class man. He never cursed. He was not one of those guys that would holler and yell at you to get his way. He just wasn't – that just wasn't him. And it's such a shame that that he's passed, but he's been retired since 1997, so we were at least prepared for his departure. It was kind of like when Randy Savage. I hate to make the comparison, but just to kind of give something back to the wrestling fans. It was like when Randy Savage retired. He had been gone for years, and then he died about 11 years later. But it still hurt. You know what I'm saying?
Oh yeah, because then now you remember the good times. You remember the, you don't think, oh well, he's been. You know, I don't even know if there's any players left that he coached in the NBA. Maybe Vince Carter.
Anton Jameson just retired, so Vince Carter is the only one.
Yeah, so there's really no ties left to the NBA, and it's been, it's been forever, it seems. Well, in this day and age, it's forever.
Mm-hmm.
But, you're just like, oh, man, remember how dominant his teams were, and it was always, huge, and the Dean Dome, and I'm just watching games on crappy little antenna TV, and it's just, it was a different era, and it just sort of brings you back to it with fond memories.
All right, and we're going to be wrapping this up, just talking about the All-Star Weekend. We might not be around. We're going to be taking a break probably, just like all the other All-Stars will be once it's over. But we're going to be talking about the All-Star Weekend. Now, the All-Star Game, we already talked about who's in, who's out, who we thought shouldn't have been, and all that. And that's fine. But I think the most interesting part is really the All-Star Weekend. It's one of the most fun – it's one of the funner portions of it. And I think we got some interesting ones, I guess, with the dunk contest. Now, there's only four participants in the dunk contest this year. Mason Plumlee, Giannis Antetokounmpo for the Milwaukee Bucks. Plumlee plays for the Nets. I forgot to mention that. Victor Oladipo with the Orlando Magic. And there's one more. Do you remember who that might be?
Is it LaVine?
Zach LaVine, yeah. Zach LaVine or LaVine with the Minnesota Timberwolves. Just give me a pick. Just give me an idea of who's going to do a spectacular dunk that's going to win it.
Who cares? Oladipo?
I think LaVine's going to do something crazy.
It lost its – once the All-Stars – backed out of it, and last year was a disaster with their freestyle round, and
yeah, that was dumb. John Wall was like a member of the East team, and the East team won the slam dunk the contest, but John Wall was a slam dunk champion because he had the most impressive dunk. It was so stupid.
Like, they're trying to salvage it, and I don't think people want it to go away. It's just you can't do it if you're these that you're dragging up bottom of the barrel names. And nobody would know who Zach LaVine LaVine is if Rubio didn't get injured, and it's just all people on the bench. And next.
What about the 3-point shootout, though? You looking forward to that?
That's going to be the most crazy thing it is, because it just, who's going to actually – who's going to miss as opposed to make
them? Here's the thing, too. Shooting threes is not as mentally taxing as it is making – like thinking up a great dunk. Or maybe the skills challenge, because I guess when you do the skills challenge, you're kind of scared that you're going to hurt your ankles or you're going to turn wrong and do something. But with shooting, you can't hurt yourself shooting the ball. All you're doing is taking a rack and you're just bombs away. So I think a lot of people would participate more in this one. And I think because of the emphasis on the three-point shot in the last couple of years, it's taken more importance because there's so much better shooters that are stars. Like, if you look way back in, like, the 90s, it was guys like Del Curry, Hersey Hawkins, Michael Adams, Danny Ainge, B.J. Armstrong, Dana Barros. They were, like, kind of, like, specialists.
It was specialists. I remember 2008, was it? It was, like, Jason Capono,
yes.
Peja, Daniel Gibson, Richard Hamilton, I think.
Wesley Person. Mm-hmm. I remember every year Wesley Person was there. Dale Ellis.
Mike Miller.
Mm-hmm.
Channing Frye was there one year.
And you'd have those star players with those star moments, like Larry Bird saying he was going to make every shot. Ray Allen, Paul Pierce played in a couple of them. I remember Michael Jordan was in it, but he was terrible.
Yeah, but it's just like this year it's so hard to handicap.
Mm-hmm.
Marco Bellinelli, Splash.
That's his second one. Steph Curry's in, this is his fourth one.
Harden. Irving.
I think it's going to be Harden.
Korver.
Oh. This is Korver's third one. This is Kyrie Irving's third one.
Yeah, but, you know, don't forget, Bellinelli is the defending champion. You're going to write him out? You know, I think Wesley Matthews and J.J. Redick will just be fodder.
And the other thing, too, is that that corner three has become such a go-to move that when they get to that corner, that's the first one you see. And that's the way it goes around the world. The first one is the corner three, and then the last one is the corner three. So you're hot to start, so you get yourself going. And then you get to the elbow, then the top of the key, the elbow again, and then you get to the corner again. So at the corner, it always gets fun because they know how many shots, how many points they need to stay alive, and usually they make every shot because people are taking that shot ad nauseum now.
So who do you pick?
I'll go with Harden.
Oh, that's who I was going to pick.
Because he can release really fast. Really fast.
All right. I'm going to say I'll just be a contrarian and say Bellinelli will repeat and shock everybody.
He's a great three-point shooter still. His three-point percentage is still, like, at the top.
I mean, yeah, but nobody's talking about him in this contest.
No. I mean, there's a few where it's like, I didn't think he would win, you know.
Okay, I'll say him or Steph Curry.
Remember when Daquan Cook won? Exactly.
That's, but, you know, it used to be specialists.
But I hope everybody enjoys the All-Star game. Those are going to be, I believe, at Barclays, and the All-Star game's at Madison Square Garden. So I hope everybody's going to be enjoying the All-Star weekend. I think it's going to be a fun one. It's going to finally be in a place where there's not like all these stupid flashlights and stuff at the Garden. It's going to be more of like a toned down, more of kind of a classic setting with classic uniforms. So I'm kind of interested in seeing how the NBA kind of decks out the All-Star weekend. But I think it'll be fun. And we're going to be finishing up. What are you going to be doing?
Just to, you know, tie everything back together, since you mentioned Daquan Cook.
Mm-hmm.
Went to the Ukrainian League last year. Now he's in the top of the French League.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, you know, he's just going to stay out there because the French League's like, well, we'll pay you good to stay here. You're our star player.
Yeah,
you're
and the D-League can only offer so much money. And what's the point of getting a 10-day contract if you know you're not going to be around for training camp in the fall?
So that's you could have a 10-day contract, you're back in the league, or you could go make like $1 million out in France.
Yeah, and obviously you're going to be one of the best players in France, unless the coach hates you and he tries to sit you down in French. And
so that's the point, is now, is he gone for good in Europe?
Mm-hmm.
That's just to tie the episode back together.
That's true. That's true. We're always trying to tie things back together. kind of like 50 Shades of Grey. But you didn't get that one?
I'm just going to leave that on you.
You know. Well, everybody leaves things on me. but on behalf of Adam Murray, this is Andrew Reich. Enjoy the All-Star game, guys. We're going to catch y'all off the bounce. Take care.